Good evening. Very nice chanting tonight. That Heart Sutra really sounded good. Sometimes it really comes together. I think we're listening to each other. And it blends, the whole thing blends, and it has a very wonderful sound. So we're in the midst of this poem, and following along Musong, the Korean monk, or the monk in the Korean tradition, who wrote this book about it. I've come to a place where I'd like to disagree with him somewhat. Last time we did 13 through 16, today is we're going to do 13 through 16. Last time we did 10 through 12. About being serene and the oneness of things. And about knowing oneness. But then he goes on to say... I've numbered each one of these sentences so that that's where those numbers come from. He doesn't do it, but you can do it if you like, and then you can know what the heck I'm talking about. So 13 is the one on page 89. Those who do not live in the single way fail both in activity and passivity, assertion and denial. Which we talked a little bit about last time. These three are talking about what he calls stepping outside of the realm of ideas and letting go of all views. It's a very, very important point. Of course, we cultivate views. Each of us has a view, and we have myriad ideas, more than we can handle sometimes. But there is a stepping aside of them, or sometimes I feel like it's stepping down underneath them and just letting them carry on as they want to without getting involved with them. I had an interesting conversation with some friends on Sunday who, several of them, suddenly burst out. We were talking about something else. And they said, I've tried and tried to meditate, and I just can't make my mind be quiet. I can't make it stop. And I think that's such a common misperception. And Musong actually goes into that on the next page over on 92. On number 16, he talks about the stillness and inner silence, he talks about, which can be misunderstood. The truth or apprehension of the nature of things happens only when the noise of internal chatter has been brought to a complete stop. But in my experience, the noise doesn't stop. Or maybe the talk goes on and maybe it's not so noisy. But in Zazen, the mind is in constant activity. It quiets down, it becomes very still sometimes, very, very still. Jack Kornfeld once did, or maybe it was Joseph Goldstein, did a two-week retreat with some of his closest students. And so the whole process got quieter and quieter and more still, and they felt so at one. And then it was over, and they all bowed, and they dedicated the merit. And then he said, the teacher said, well, let's do it for another couple of weeks. And they were at that stage where they thought, well, yes, let's do it. Let's see what happens. They had to start all over again. The whole process started from the beginning. There isn't any final stopping place. And there isn't any straight line of the brain as the brain is measured. It's always moving. Always in activity. If it's a straight line, you're dead. That's how they know. So, but there are aspects of the brain activity that we can't experience unless we sit. And sitting, in my experience and my knowledge from my teachers, is that the more we're able to allow it to be what it wants to be, the more peaceful it can be, and the more still, the stillness that Musong is talking about. If we try to make it still, try to accomplish this, it just puts us in competition with ourselves. There's the one of us that wants to be quiet, and there's the one of us that isn't being quiet, and it just makes it more. So the best way is just to embrace whatever is there and see how it constantly is changing. It doesn't stay the same. And there are many states of mind that come and go for us. And many wonderful things that happen, and many scary things too. Somebody else asked me not long ago, somebody I hardly knew, and he suddenly said, yeah, do you have bad thoughts? And I said, yeah. He said, really? He said, I have these terrible thoughts sometimes, and I was afraid I was the only one. And I think we all have that feeling too sometimes. So it's important to have a perspective on what's going on with us so that it's not... It doesn't feel so alien and so threatening. In number 15, he talks about where was that? About the evolution of language, Musong. What the poem says is, the more you talk and think about it, the farther astray you wander from the truth. And certainly that is the truth. And we can get in a tremendous tangle of thinking, trying to figure everything out. And that's why I often, when people come with a huge problem and they've been chewing and chewing and chewing, I say, just sit down. Just sit down with it. And don't chew on it. Just let it be whatever it wants to be. And often an answer comes. We don't create an answer ourselves. We don't cook it up. It just is a gift to us. So much of what happens in our mind is a gift to us. And often we're somewhere else and we don't so easily receive it. So the evolution of language he's talking about, Musong. He says that when we use language as the representation of reality, we end up creating a dead-end construct for ourselves that leads, he says, to existential despair. The problem here is how the language is used by the grasping mind, not the intrinsic structure of language itself. So how it is that we are able to speak about things and explain things. We're always explaining things, explaining ourselves, explaining our world, and using the language that we were born into. Carl Jung also said, you seek limits and restraints so that you do not lose yourself tumbling into infinity. This is a much more vivid image than the one that Musong used. The existential despair, he says, we're afraid of tumbling into infinity, which means we're afraid of dying. In the back of everybody's mind is the knowledge that we are going to have to die. And so Jung says, the word is protective magic. You speak the magic word of the limitless, and the limitless is finally banished. Because of that, men seek and make words. I think they're the kind of words that are the kind of way that we go to the movies in order to not have to think about things too seriously or for too long or to contemplate the way things are. And if we're talking about the truth, which the poem is, then the more we try to talk about the truth, the farther away we get from it. So I should shut up right now. It's hopeless. On the other hand, there's some ways of using words that we, in Zen, we say it's like a finger pointing to the moon. You can't say what it is, but you can direct the attention toward in a certain way that creates an openness to an experience. Can't give the experience, but you can give the opportunity to look in a certain way. So music provides that, any art, and any true art, I think, that is the reason for it. It's why we are willing to try. So that reminds me, the more you talk and think about it, the farther astray you wander, it reminds me of that old koan about the student who asked the master about the truth. And the master, instead of getting into a long discussion about the truth, points to the oak tree that's standing in the patio right there. And he says, it's the oak tree. The student says, huh, that's just a tree. But the truth is, that was the experience of that moment. And that's the truth. That's so close to us, it's so intimate inside our skin that we hardly even notice that this is the truth. This moment, this life, this position that we find ourselves in, this breath, and this mysterious future that we have no idea what it is, and the strange past that we hardly can understand. It has so many strange things in it that we never could have possibly imagined. This moment includes all of that. But that's what the truth is. And that's what he's pointing to here. So that the more we open up in Zazen, the more we are, the less entranced we are by our ideas and our fancy thinking, the more available we are to where we are and who we are, to the marvel and strangeness and, well, that's enough. Marvel and strangeness is enough of what this is. I went to a very interesting workshop on Saturday, at IMC, Insight Meditation Center. And Stephen Batchelor was there. And Stephen Batchelor is a very interesting writer, Buddhist, who has practiced in all three traditions. He started out as a hippie going to India in the 70s, I guess, 70s or 80s, and ran into the Dalai Lama and got involved with the Gelugpa tradition and had a Lama teacher, and was chosen to translate Shantideva. It's a very good translation. It's with Del Deshi Gyatso. It's a very well-known one. And he was sent to Switzerland to set up one of the first European Zen centers in the Tibetan tradition. And then he got in a big argument with his Lama teacher about past lives and rebirth. And in the Tibetan tradition, you have to believe in rebirth. There's no question. And he tried and tried to believe it. And he said he never could. It just didn't make sense to him. So then his Lama said, well, you know, you're not really a Buddhist then. You don't really fit. So he quit and he went to Korea and became a Zen monk in a Korean monastery, in the toughest, most old Korean monastery, where they do 108 prostrations at 3 o'clock in the morning when they get up and sit until very late. It's an extremely tough regimen. And then he met a nun there, a French woman, and married her. And that took care of being a monk, so he probably stopped being a monk first. And then they moved to England, back to England where he came from in the beginning, where he was born, and joined Gaia House, which is a Vipassana center. It's become a big Vipassana center now. And so he's done all three of the main practices. He says he hasn't done Pure Land, but he's done all the other three main ones. And he's now a kind of renegade. He wrote a book called Buddhism Without Belief, which has turned everybody on their head. There were a lot of very surprised people about that. And now he's got a new book called Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, which he said the publishers created. They made up that title. It's not really about that at all. It's what he calls a foundation Buddhist practice, about going back and looking at Buddha's life and what it was like to be there at that time, and what kind of relationship Buddha had with people, and what he meant by his teaching, especially the Four Noble Truths. And he's gone back especially to the Four Noble Truths. And he said that the emphasis is already always on the first two, that life is suffering, which is certainly true, and that there are reasons for suffering, and the reasons are that we're always clutching at things, either clutching at things or trying to get rid of them. That we are so distracted by our suffering that all we can think is to get things that make us sweeten up again, or get rid of the things that we think are responsible for what's hurting us. And he said, people don't talk about the Eightfold Path, which is how to create a life. And if each one is creating a life, it's creating a world. So that we're so involved with our own process as Buddhists that we often forget that there's a whole unfolding as a world that we are, that we can become, we can transform. I thought that was very interesting. And I think that's what this poem is talking about also. How we can be authentically in the world and make a functioning world as best we can. He goes into Castaneda in this, it's number 16, which is not usually brought up anymore. There was an era when Castaneda was the big deal with his magic, shamanistic kind of experiences, and maybe some of you don't even know about Castaneda. He was supposedly an anthropologist who went into Mexico and found, or was found by a shaman, and began to be instructed in how to have transpersonal kinds of experiences. So it's really fun to read. It's been a little bit challenged. Since then, he's apparently not really an anthropologist, and he didn't have such a background as he promised that he did. And nobody knows whether the shaman actually existed or not, or whether it just came out of his own imagination. But it's like these visions that I'm reading in Jung, that they're real. You know, a vision can be real without having any place on right here. As instruction, as opening us up to the bigger space. No questions?
Again, being that words are trying to describe something again. My experience is, I mean, it's never quiet unless I'm sleeping, and then it's never even quiet then because I got all these dreams going on when I'm on the cushion too. You know? Yet it's that I notice it, and notice thoughts more, which I guess is the metaphor of being clear. Yes. Or that I can notice something, or yeah, it's very, very interesting. So again, trying to put words to that whole experience.
Well, I think I mentioned the scientists who are studying the brain who said that meditators are so different from people who don't meditate because they can measure, if they teach people just off the street how to meditate and then hook them up and then make a loud noise around them, that they will react to the loud noise and then just start spinning out. They never come back to the meditation. And meditators, long-term meditators in the same situation hooked up in a loud noise, immediately drop the meditation. They're measuring it, the brain waves. They connect with what it was and then come right back. Completely flexible. They said flexibility is what meditation gives us. And the flexibility is connecting with whatever is incoming, but always returning to the place where we live. So that
the practice.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so it's not that there's no stillness. It's stillness in activity.
I remember when I finished up because did a retreat at the San Francisco Zen Center, which I know many of you have. But there was one day we're in there sitting, and I was, I think, up on the baton almost out the window, and you can't really see the street, but sirens were going off.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all just right there. Yeah. First thing I see a hook and ladder coming up. And every, you know, I just said, oh, this is so weird. We're all just sitting in here, just, you know, like trying to be still and everything. But it was so interesting. It's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's hook and ladder. Oh, yeah, yeah, there's sirens. It's just the most bizarre thing.
Well, we have the roaring of the traffic. Yeah. There's always something going on. People at Chikoji used to complain to me about the Blue Jays. We're trying to meditate. It should be peaceful and quiet here. Please make those Blue Jays go away.
Blue Jays are nothing. Remember at Green Gulch, I went to a couple of sessions. People were cutting wood with their chainsaw, not that far away, but it, anyway, kind of made me, I think, you know, you disagree with them, but it's just a matter of a very slight shift, sort of a relative shift. It made me think, when he said, you have to be totally still or quit thoughts completely, and you said you can't. Just kind of reminded me tonight. I have my mind's been so active because I'm pretty busy at work, and I kind of get pretty revved up. so sometimes, like tonight, I just couldn't settle down.
Mm-hmm.
Last week was totally different. I just
yes.
But the point is, it's always different.
Yes.
And the practice is just an imperfect practice, but like any habit, if you keep doing it long enough, you might get better at it. Or yeah, at least you think you get better at it. But eventually, I think we do settle down.
I think we, yeah.
Often enough, you know, you can get into it and settle down a lot faster and stay settled down a lot longer, but that doesn't mean that things aren't going to come up and disrupt that. Yeah, because, but then accepting them as just these things. You know, and not getting disrupted by them.
Yes.
The real art of it, you know, like anything, like the chainsaw. At the year at Green Gold or the Blue Jay, you know, or the Sirens. I've been at City Center too when I think there was some kind of a, where you hear people talking in the street.
Yeah, oh
yeah. On the sidewalk.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think the inside people have a pretty interesting practice that I have called noting, which I don't really try to deal with. It's kind of like, okay. You say, I'm sitting here in the chair, I'm raising my hand. To me, that's a little bit too
strong. Yeah. It's extra.
On the other hand, we're doing that.
Without words. Without projecting on it.
Making a checklist.
Yeah.
We're sort of a checklistless inside meditators of Buddhism, I guess.
I think the important thing is to be modest about the practice. The more ambitious we are, even about achieving oneness and one-pointedness and all of those wonderful things, the more ambitious we are about it, the farther away we are from it. It just gets in the way. And if we think that we're doing it, then that gets in the way. It actually comes to us. We don't go to it. We offer ourselves to it. As Coben said once, it's like sending a love letter and many love letters and hoping that you'll get an answer sometime. Ah, here I am. And sometimes we do. Sometimes it's... But it's a kind of grace. So it's almost 8:00. I have a couple of announcements. One is that I've said this a little bit before, but I'll encourage it again because Julian is here. I haven't looked at it yet, but I've got the movie about Dogen that is supposed to be a really cool movie. And you thought that you could set something up to that we could see it here?
I need to ask my work about, I guess, we wanted a projection and have it at the other ones.
We could have
it. So I think,
Yeah.
I will inquire into that tomorrow.
Okay.
So next week I could report back.
Good.
Yeah. See exactly what kind of projector. I mean, it's a typical thing where you have the white screen, and so I don't know how.
We could rent one. We could rent one.
It's a DVD?
Sheet?
Yeah, it's a DVD.
Yeah.
Could you get like a 7-inch laptop and put it on a chair?
We don't
do it. Dogen is big as life. Also, Julian, you asked for the names of the Buddha ancestors.
Oh, the whole...
and I've brought them. One side is the women and the other side is the men.
Oh, wow.
So I brought enough for everybody. When you've been ordained, you're supposed to chant that every day. And I'm afraid we haven't ever developed that practice. But you might want to try it. I'll show you when it comes back around how it sounds. In a zendo. In the meantime, there is going to be a visitor coming on the 13th of April. Vanya's going to be in town. So just to keep you all informed, he's going to come and he said he'd give a talk. He's bringing somebody with him. I don't know who. So it should be, as always, an interesting. Vanya is my teacher, through my teacher, I guess. Coben died a little bit too soon, and so Vanya, thank you, Ellie. Vanya finished things up for me. So that's, he's part of my lineage, part of the ancestors that are on my list. So the first Buddhas here are the Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, going back into the mists of time. And then there's Shakyamuni Buddha, Maha Kashyapo, Ananda. Some of those you'll find Dogen in there at the bottom of the list, the long list. And it sounds like this. Bibashi butsu dayosho, shiki butsu dayosho, bishabu butsu dayosho, kurasam butsu dayosho, kunagamuni butsu dayosho, kasho butsu dayosho, shakamuni butsu dayosho, makakasho dayosho, ananda dayosho, shona washi dayosho, ubakikuta dayosho, daitaka dayosho, michaka dayosho, bashumitsu. It's very fun to do. It's really cool. And you can't think, you just have to go. And let it come rolling out. For a long, long time, this is the only one that we had. And then there started to be conferences every summer that a few women over in the East Bay started up for women in Buddhism, where one of the things they decided was that we ought to have women's names in this. So this is the original list. It's a much longer list at Zen Center now. But this is the first list. And it goes Acharya Mahapajapati, Acharya Mita, Acharya Yasodhara, Acharya Tissa, Acharya Sumanna, Acharya Upasama, etc. So once you get used to it, it goes very quickly. And also, there's some feeling that goes with it about who these were and who was behind all of these people, that they also practiced, and their students practiced, and their students practiced, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha and all the way up to here. It's still alive. And that's why we chant this. And sometimes I sort of feel all the ancestors around as if they haven't gone. They're still with us as we practice. So I'm very glad you asked.
I'm just looking at this. I always think of Shakyamuni is the first one, but there's Bibashi.
Yeah, they're the Buddhas of the past. The Buddhas that nobody remembers anymore, but it's obvious that there must have been Buddhas before Shakyamuni. So those are sort of made-up names. They go so far back, maybe they're Lucy's grandpas or something.
Thank you for bringing that up.
You're welcome. And I think there's a sign-up for the May 1st sit at Connie's, is that true? Or did we get...
No.
Not yet. Yeah. There's going to be. We're going to have a one-day sit-up at Connie Batten's house up in the mountains, about 40 minutes from here, 45 minutes from here. Very beautiful place that we've been invited to come and to... She wants to cook for us, make a nice lunch for us, and... So I hope you all save May Day for that. It's going to be beautiful up there. It will be unbelievably beautiful. So that's it. Vanya on the 13th and Connie on the 1st.